This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Would you like 2023 to be tax-free? Hey, it's Lars. Then make plans to join David Moore for a free webinar Wednesday, March 29th at 10 a.m. Pacific time for the latest 1031 exchange news and updates. For those asking for the nitty-gritty of a 1031 exchange, this is your class to learn the basics of the 1031 exchange, what qualifies, and how to apply the process. In this webinar, you'll learn the lingo, a glossary of terms, what you should know about doing an exchange in 2023, the benefits and pitfalls, and flipping with a 1031 exchange. If you're an Oregon broker, this 1031 exchange class provides attendees with 1 hour of core real estate continuing education and the knowledge to identify and apply the 1031 exchange to client investment real estate transactions. Plus, anybody who signs up gets a copy of the slides and a link to view the session again. For more information and registration, go to 1031exchange.com. You've worked hard to earn your money. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So the schools admit that they are being overwhelmed by the violent acts of children and the threatened violence within the schools. And they say, what can we possibly do? You know what? I do have an answer to it. It's very, very simple. But their answer is, we need to hire more staff, more counselors. We've got to have more specialists. No, that's not the answer at all. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. It's a great conversation every day, and you're invited to take part. And if you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, you know, you think I'm full of baloney, go ahead and call in. Be a naysayer. We'll put you right to the head of the line. We always have at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you'd rather email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. Tried to make the address simple for you. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, we'll get to that in just a moment. But we put up a brand new question every single day based on the news of the day. So it's fresh. It's ready for you. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And I'll tell you what, this is the craziness that we've got. When you have folks in charge of your kids, folks who in most cases are spending about, well, they're spending about half of the money in an average state budget is spent on public education. It's an important task for them to do. I get that. They need a lot of money. Well, I don't necessarily get that, because America spends more than every other industrialized country on earth per kid per year, and we get lousy results. But even with all that, you'd at the least think they could keep some kind of order in the schools. Let me tell you what the latest complaint is. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We have spent the last more than 23 years serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and providing, I hope, every day, honestly provocative talk radio. So glad to have you listening all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Let me tell you about this problem, though, and the latest example of it, because there are examples from every one of the three states. But in middle schools in Portland, they say we're facing a crisis in student behavior. Now, right there, I could almost stop reading the story and saying, I know why you have a crisis. You have a crisis because a bunch of woke folks, and I'm going to state this bluntly so you understand what's happening and what the logic is, or lack of logic, that they're using. A few years ago, and I began talking about this subject a few years ago, the school said, hey, we're doing discipline in the schools. We are disciplining kids. In some cases, we're suspending kids if their behavior gets that bad. And if their behavior gets especially bad, we expel them from school. And they say, but we've noticed that when we do that, a disproportionate share of the kids we expel or suspend or discipline happen to be students of color, black and brown students. And you say, we just can't have that. The numbers make us look bad. So their solution was, let's just cut down on discipline dramatically. So in other words, you have behavior problems in the school. You're taking care of it with discipline that is orderly and applied in a colorblind manner, and yet it's always produced, and it always did. I looked at the numbers myself. It always produced a disproportionate share, meaning that let's say if 10% of the kids in the school were, as they politely and I guess politically correctly call it, students of color. If 10% of the kids are POC or BIPOC, and you're disciplining 20% or 30%, and the numbers were that bad, it looks embarrassing to, you know, all the liberals who run public schools. So they said the answer isn't to find a way to actually communicate to the kids. If you get out of line, there are going to be consequences. So they said, no, our answer is we'll just cut down on discipline dramatically. Now, anybody who's ever parented kids would tell you, so your kids aren't behaving right, and your answer is to not have any consequences for bad behavior? Well, then you're going to get more bad behavior. That's common sense. But, of course, that's probably coming from somebody like you or me who doesn't have a PhD or a master's in education. Because when you have a master's in education, you throw common sense out the window. Even though you're spending billions of dollars of the public's money, and even though you're in charge of very young, very impressionable kids, and your answer instead is to communicate to them, when you behave badly, there will be little, if any, consequences. So what are the public schools saying now at this point? They've got a letter signed by the middle school principals from 15 different schools. They say 6th through 8th graders have had more disciplinary incidents through the end of March than for the entire 2021-2022 school year. Think about that for a moment. You've already got more bad behavior in a four-month period than you had in an entire school year just a year or two ago. Now, the principal at Robert Gray Middle School, for example, Lisa Newellen, who actually wrote the letter, she says disruptive conduct, harassment toward fellow students because of race, because of disability, because of religion, and physical altercations, she writes, are on the rise. Well, that's crazy. So what are they asking for? What do they say is the solution? They say, let's go back to the discipline model. No. They're asking the district, will you hire 15 new full-time employees who will focus on student safety, mental health, and alternative approaches to discipline that emphasize mediation instead of a more punitive system of detention and suspension? Now, if that makes sense to any of you, I'd love to take the naysayer call. But she says, we need help. The things I worry about as a building administrator, issues of mental health and anxiety, that's all good. Microaggressions towards students is something we are problem solving all the time, along with threats of violence and actual fighting. They actually had some kids say, if we don't get nude pictures of some of the girls, it was boys asking, we're going to come to school with guns. That's the level that they're talking about. I've got a plan for them instead. And I think my plan is very simple. Number one, enforce every single rule that you've already got on the books. Number two, suspend or expel when warranted, and do it in a colorblind manner. If you happen to end up with a whole bunch of black and brown kids who get suspended or expelled, so be it. Just enforce the rules in a colorblind manner. And then my final suggestion, and it's the one I really don't expect the school administrators to actually adopt. When a crime happens on campus, call the police and have them arrest the accused criminal. I don't care if the accused criminal is 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. There are some 19-year-old high school students, believe it or not. But if you say, when you assault somebody, you're not living in a little bubble. This school is not a bubble. It is inside of the state of Oregon, Washington, or Idaho. What you have to do is enforce the law. An assault is a crime. If it's a crime, call the police. Have consequences. I would be willing to bet that if you actually crack down hard that way, you would send the message. You want to get out of line? Fine. There are consequences. That when you do that, you'll actually get good behavior. As you can tell, their answer was stop the discipline. We don't want to do suspensions and expulsions. It looks embarrassing to all these politically correct types that run the schools. Why, there are too many black and brown kids getting suspended or expelled. So be it. But if your answer then, 2 or 3 years ago, was to stop the discipline and what you got was more violence, that's what you're going to get till you go back to the old system. Back in just a moment, I'd be glad to get your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right.
You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
If the stench of unwashed bodies of homeless drug addicts and human waste bothers you, Portland can't help you out with that. But if the exhaust of delivery trucks bringing things to buy or sell to your city's core is your thing, Portland's about to ban them. A Joe Biden bribe of $2 million persuaded city leadership to put 16 square blocks of downtown off limits to gasoline and diesel delivery trucks. Zero emissions only when the zone starts, and the city plans to install sensors to detect any of those evil fossil fuel trucks that invade the special zone. Imagine you run a small business in Portland that still actually makes a bottom line. And you gotta love the federal bureaucrats like Gabe Klein from the U.S. Joint Office of Energy and Transportation, who describes the new rules as, quote, you intermediate that freight and put it on a lighter vehicle. So every delivery to, say, your small coffee shop must be brought to the edge of the zero emission zone and then be unloaded from one truck, you know, the evil fossil fuel truck, and loaded up on another battery-powered rig so it can arrive at your door. If Antifa riots and BLM looting, homeless campers, and rising violent crime hasn't already done enough destruction of Portland's Central Business District, this ought to do the trick. It is one of nine cities around America that have accepted these bribes from Biden to do this kind of thing. I think it's going to do tremendous damage, and don't expect that they won't extend it to every other corner of America. And all of this to save planet Earth. Goods mostly made in China with the electricity from coal, carried here on ships powered by oil, then trucks and trains powered by diesel to get it to Portland. But take heart, the last 2,000 yards of that long trip will be both clean and green. From Truth Social, John writes in, Lars, if I shorten the barrel and rainbow spray paint my AR-15, could I say it's transitioning from being an assault weapon to an all-inclusive emotional support hole punch? Keep up the good work, signed John. For our question of the day, which is actually posed by my Seattle talk radio brother, Ari Hoffman, who's on our affiliate station, KVI, he poses today's question. Yesterday, while banning assault weapons, Governor Jay Inslee, actually it was Tuesday, said no one needs an AR-15. So Ari asked his office, when will the Washington State Patrol that provides his protection stop packing assault weapons that are on the list of banned firearms? He asked that of the Washington State Patrol. This was their response, and it really ought to scare you. Quote, as I'm sure you're aware, the law exempts law enforcement and military. Actually, it doesn't exempt military because of their unique needs to be prepared for extreme contingencies. The governor was talking about daily civilian life. So rules for thee, but not for me. Oh, and by the way, according to the Washington State Patrol's own website, which provides protection for both the governor and the legislature that passed this crazy law, the AR platform is the primary long gun armament of the state patrol. So again, if you're in government, you get special rights. If you're just a citizen, well, they just turned you from a citizen into a subject. At least that's my point of view. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing. Don't stop,
grow. Well, before I tell you about what it is that caused me to award today's Daily Grill to the ABC television affiliate KATU and to its reporter Christine Giardinelli, let me tell you this first. I always reach out to the people I'm going to give the grill to, and I always give them a fair chance to respond. But I'm giving the grill to K2 and Christine Giardinelli in particular because they did a story. There's a bill before the Oregon legislature right now, and it would codify into state law. I know they'd like to have it in the state constitution, God forbid that, but they want to put into law what they call abortion rights. Now, I don't think there is any right to abortion, but states can certainly pass laws about it. But they want to put this into state law. And in the middle of Giardinelli's story, She wrote this, and I would say it is more than deceptive. It borders on lying to the audience. Now, I warn you about mainstream media all the time, but about this bill to put so-called abortion rights into Oregon law, quote from her story, those in favor of the bill say not requiring parental consent. Let me jump in and say parenthetically, they're talking about saying that girls as young as 10 years of age will be able to get an abortion without their parents' permission, without their parents' knowledge. But she says those in favor of the bill say not requiring parental consent is already the status quo in Oregon because it's a right afforded nationwide by Roe v. Wade. And they say it's implied in Oregon statutes that allow reproductive care without parents' consent. I got two objections to this. Number one, apparently the newsroom at KATU was unaware that all the way back last June, Roe v. Wade was thrown out by the United States Supreme Court in a case called Dobbs. They said it's up to the states. So Roe v. Wade isn't there anymore. But apparently Christine Giardinelli is not aware that Roe v. Wade is not active anymore. Because Roe v. Wade pretended to say somewhere in the Constitution, we found a right to abortion, and the current Supreme Court said, nope, it ain't there. There is no federal constitutional right to abortion. But apparently the K2 newsroom is unaware of that. The second thing, though, and this is a little more nuanced, but think about this. She says when Roe v. Wade was in effect, and this story is just from this week, when Roe v. Wade was in effect, it allowed children to obtain abortions without their parents' knowledge or consent because it's a federal constitutional right. I say, hold on a second. When they passed the 21st Amendment that overturned prohibition of alcohol in America, did that mean that 10-year-olds could go out and get a bottle of whiskey and drink as much as they want without their parents knowing about it under color of law? No, it did not. The fact that you ended prohibition and said, Americans now have a right to drink alcohol, did not extend that right to children. And every constitutional right is subject to time, place, and manner restrictions. She's making the argument as though you could say, well, when they passed the 21st Amendment, kids could drink booze. No, they can't. And she's saying that because even when Roe v. Wade was in the law, that children could obtain abortions and that their right to do so without their parents' sign-off is encompassed in Roe v. Wade when it was still law. Up till June of last year. I don't know about people in newsrooms, but I understand that a lot of them are screaming left-wing liberals, and maybe that describes Christine Giardinelli. But the fact that she doesn't know that Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court really suggests there's a serious problem there. Our best email so far today, but you can send more. This comes from Andrew in Bellingham. Lars, it is good advice to be prepared. As he was, the leader of the free world, Joe, be prepared, Boy Scout Biden, had been given the answer to a question that a favored reporter was going to ask him. Biden appeared largely in charge with no Easter bunny to guide him. Reminds me of Hillary Clinton breezily responding to inane questions from David Letterman when she was carpetbagging to be a New York U.S. senator. She, too, was following a script given to her in advance. I now know how Biden received 15 million more votes than Barack Obama. Yeah, it was a setup and it was a cheat all along. Signed, Andrew in Bellingham. It's Thursday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. That's what we call it. Seems to be a lot of conspiracy theories. How about this? Our Twitter poll, should schools require teachers to lie to parents about a student's gender transition? There are actually districts being sued for doing exactly that. I would say no. You shouldn't be lying to parents. If anything, you should be overly abundant with the truth when it comes to parents about the children in your care. You know, that in loco parentis stuff. Find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And join me in welcoming back to the program Representative Ed Deal, who represents Oregon's District 17, to talk about whether or not tax dollars should be spent on abortion and gender-affirming treatment. Representative Deal, good to have you on.
Lars, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure, but this House Bill 2002 has angered more people, at least based on the phone calls and the emails I get. Would you mind sounding off on that? Because you tried to actually do something about this.
Yeah, it's a horrendous bill, Lars, on so many fronts. You know, First off, with the abortion expansion, you know, this bill would allow a girl at any age to have an abortion without parental consent or knowledge. And a 15-year-old girl could choose to be sterilized without parental consent or knowledge. It is a state wedge between parental rights and the child. And the Supreme Court has said time and time again that parents have the fundamental right to direct the upbringing of their children. So to deny that to parents with this law is outrageous.
Can I stop you for a moment, Representative Deal?
Sure.
Just to put, I mean, this is how outrageous it is. Tell me, there was a moment during one of the hearings on this nonsense in which a rep, and it might have been you, the rep, who asked, does this mean a 10-year-old girl can get an abortion without her parents knowing about it? And there was literally, well, you tell me what the reaction was inside that room when that question was asked and what the answer was that was given.
And I believe that was Senator Knope that asked that question, and there were gasps. There were gasps from the people that sponsored the bill. And
unbelievable.
Statements
from
that,
the from no, the no hold true. On just I want to I there are things I want to put a punctuation, and I think you understand the people who sponsored the bill when they heard the answer, yes, a 10-year-old can get a state paid abortion and her parents won't know about it, can't know about it, can't say anything about it, even the people who sponsored it were aghast, like, oh my God, what are you doing? And they sponsored the bill, right?
They were, and they claimed to be intimate with the bill. And it was the lawyer, the legal counsel, that was testifying that confirmed that, yes, indeed, that is true. That is true.
So but, I guess if you were a person of faith, Representative Deal, you might have said, forgive them. They know not what they do.
Yes. but they're changing their story now, Lars. So in defense of denying these parental rights, the Democrats are now saying the bill is simply status quo in Oregon. They're saying it's a right afforded nationwide by Roe v. Wade. And then they claim it's always been implied in Oregon statute that minors like this can get reproductive care without parental consent. So this is news to us.
Hold on. By the way, reproductive care in this case means halting reproduction by killing the baby. That's what we call reproduction. This is like, it's like 1984, Brave New World all over again, isn't it?
It is. And they refer to a specific Oregon law, ORS 109.610. And they said this statute implies access to abortion, even though it doesn't explicitly state it. So we looked it up. My office looked it up. ORS 109.610, right to care for certain sexually transmitted infections without parental consent.
A child's so now an infection?
They think a statute.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Oh, my God.
That allows a treatment of an infection, sexually transmitted infection, gives them the right to do an abortion on a 10-year-old without parental consent. Now, explain that to me.
I got to tell you something. I just gave chapter and verse to this young lady. She's a reporter at the ABC affiliate K2. And as a politician, you don't want to get on the wrong side of reporters. But I have no problem calling out Christine Giardinelli. She apparently listened to this garbage and then just regurgitated it on the air. She said those in favor of the bill say not requiring parental consent is already status quo in Oregon because it's a right afforded nationwide by Roe v. Wade. And they say it's implied that Oregon statutes allow reproductive care without parents' consent. She just regurgitated it, and apparently the ABC affiliate, television affiliate, is unaware that Roe v. Wade was thrown out June of last year?
Yeah, she did state it. Fortunately, she stated the statute. I don't think anybody bothered to look it up and see what the statute really says. But it's a game they're playing. They're trying to cover for something that they themselves were surprised was in the bill. And so now they're trying to find cover to say, well, it's been this way all along. So the question is, are you saying that, go ahead, Lars.
Well, and I just thought I'd throw this in. If Roe v. Wade were still law, it ain't. The Supreme Court threw it out, said, and Dobbs, it goes to the states. But think about this, Representative Deal. The 21st Amendment ended prohibition and said Americans can drink booze, right? Right?
Yes.
Okay. Ended prohibition. Does that mean that 10-year-olds can drink whiskey and buy it from the state of Oregon? Because the 21st Amendment says Americans can drink booze. That 10-year-old is an American. So therefore, based on the logic of your honorable colleagues in the legislature, when the 21st Amendment ended prohibition, it meant 10-year-olds can drink whiskey.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense. And it's like they scrambled to find some statute that they think they could slip it into, and it's pretty outrageous to me.
Is this going to become law?
Well, we're fighting it with everything we have, but this is one of the big signature pieces of legislation for this session. And, you know, this is coming down from the top. I think the governor, the speaker, they're driving this. And so there's not a lot we can do to stop it. What I've been pushing for really hard is at least take the most egregious things out of it. I mean, 80% of Americans, Democrat, Republican, Independent, believe that parents have a fundamental right to direct the care and upbringing of their children. Yep. This bill flies right in the face of that. And the other thing that people are very upset about is this bill mandates insurance coverage for what they call gender-affirming treatment, while at the same time specifically excluding that treatment to kids that have been harmed and wish to detransition back. It specifically excludes health insurance mandates for them.
You tried to get the detransition in there, didn't you? And you were flatly refused. Am I right?
I did. Yeah, I introduced a -11 amendment that would have treated basically detransitioners the same as the transitioners.
So you can go one way, according to the Democrats, but you can't come home. You can transition away from your gender, and the state will pay for it, and your parents need not know, but you can't ever go back home. Representative Ed Deal, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. It is a Thursday. Your calls are welcome. It's also the Radio Northwest Network, and I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Expecting some great naysayers today if they've got the stones to do it. 866-439-5277. Send your emails, talk@LarsLarson.com, on the Radio Northwest Network.
When you can fry an egg on the sidewalk.
I'm making breakfast. You want some eggs?
When your AC is on 24 hours a day.
I am begging you, put the air conditioner on.
And when your legs stick to the seats of your car.
No, I can't feel my legs.
It's too damn hot. You know why? Global warming. Allegedly. This is the Global Warming Minute on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to tell you something. That crazy edict that's been put down by the city of Portland after a $2 million bribe from Joe Biden's administration that says that soon, we don't have an exact start date, but soon, all fossil fuel delivery trucks will be banned from 16 square blocks at the central core of downtown Portland. And if you say, well, thank goodness I don't live in Portlandia, I think it's coming to every city in America. They're starting it out with 9 American cities for starters. But if you're in a city where they haven't done this yet, they probably will very soon. And then I saw the comments of a guy who really ought to know his stuff. His name is Andrew Boyle. He is the first vice chairman of the American Transportation Association. And why does he hold that spot? Because he's the co-president of the Massachusetts-based company called Boyle Transportation. So he went to Washington, D.C. this week to testify about the idea of having America's trucks just switched over very, very quickly to from diesel and gasoline, mostly diesel, especially for the long hauls, and gasoline for local delivery in some cases. And he testified that this was kind of a joke. Take a listen. We'll have that sound bite.
We're clear on the scale of the issue, each electric vehicle battery for a heavy-duty truck weighs 8,000 pounds, and you need at least 2 of them. So we're talking the weight of, 4 or 5 cars. And are my friends and peers in the industry nationwide who have tried to make efforts to put in, say, hey, I'm going to convert a dozen forklifts to electric, or I want to tee up a facility for 30 electric trucks. There is no power. The utilities come back, the cities come back and say, is this some kind of joke?
Yeah, is this some kind of joke? Because the cities literally respond to this by saying, oh, you want to electrify all those trucks and they consume gigantic amounts of electricity? No, you can't have it. You're putting too much draw on the whole system, and that's for relatively small things like converting all the forklifts in a factory or a warehouse over to electric, or as he said, 30 electric vehicles. Take a listen to this, his second soundbite from that testimony before the U.S. Congress.
One friend tried to put in Illinois a facility, tee it up for 30 trucks electrification. The city came back and said, this is some kind of joke. You're asking for more draw than the entire city requires. And just to give you an idea, 30, 50 trucks, that's like a 5-6 megawatt application. The factory that makes the trucks is a 2 megawatt factory.
So you can see the practical side of this. I know there are people who say, well, we want to go to electric trucks. They're cleaner and greener and all that good stuff. And here's the city of Portland telling every business in that 16 square block area, you're only allowed to have deliveries made by zero emissions vehicles. And those businesses are going to fail under those standards unless they're given an exemption. In any case, thought I'd tell you about that. Let me go to Bruce in Bellingham. And if you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers, of course, go first. Bruce, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, I'm calling about the Washington State House Bill 5599. It's the one that was passed by the legislature, which is a gender-affirming care for minors without parental consent.
Yep.
And Inslee hasn't signed it yet. However, it has been passed by the House. And so I'm calling because I've got a phone number for Inslee's office. If I can state that on the air.
I would love to have you state it as long as you do this. I think people should calmly and not profanely call the governor's office and express their opinion. That's the only thing I'd ask, Bruce, is that we have the right to petition our government for redress of grievances. It helps your case if you do it without swear words or words you can't say on the radio, and do make a calm, cogent case for why that bill should never be signed by Jay Inslee. Go ahead and give it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, and thank you. That number is 360-902-4111, and it's between the hours of 8 and 5 weekdays.
Okay. I think that's a perfectly acceptable way to do it. If you melt, and that is actually the number that's online, so it's not like we're telling you some secret information, but I think it makes perfect sense to have people melt the phone lines. And I'll tell you, Bruce, I know a lot of people despair that they could ever change what the government is going to do. I've watched for decades as politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, have said, we're going to pass this bill, we're going to sign this bill. And then you say, no, we're going to melt your phone lines down. We're going to have so many people call you that you're going to sit back and say, this is not such a good idea. And it actually does work. So I appreciate you making the suggestion. Jay Inslee has not signed the bill yet. And by the way, $55.99 in Washington state, I mean, Oregon's bad enough, but in Washington state, they literally say that if your child says to a teacher, a counselor, social worker, whatever, I want to transition. I'm not sure how my parents are going to react. They might not be happy about that. That social worker is allowed to direct them to go to a shelter. And then the shelter, which is ordinarily required to tell the parents where that missing child is required under this bill to keep that information secret, to hide the kids, to effectively kidnap the kids so they can do a gender transition and be changed for the rest of their lives. That's crazy. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits. At least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about immigration and specifically about illegal aliens. And I guess it's, I think it's fairly simple for me to understand this, that there was a time in America's history where the states played a role in whether or not you could come into the United States legally. And that role was erased a long, long time ago because the Constitution says that the federal government and only the federal government has the entire say about who emigrates to America. I mean, if states could grant legal status in the United States, you could have one state grant legal status. And because there are no limits on traveling from one state to another of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama fan, but that's another story, that you could have one state just granting, entry to the United States right and left, and all those people would go somewhere else. So it's all the federal government's job. And in fact, I'm not the only one who believes that. The lawyers believe it. Even the Barack Obama administration, back when Obama was president, said to Arizona, you have no business enforcing immigration law. So what happens when states pass laws that declare a state a sanctuary? And there are a number of them that have done that. There are even cities that say they can declare sanctuary status. And what that means is that when the federal government says we're looking for illegal aliens, that state or those cities say, yeah, we don't know anything about that. We're not going to help you out at all. Well, there are some people in law enforcement who are fighting back. And one of the people fighting on their behalf is Chris Hayek, who is director of litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute. Chris, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you. Fine.
Tell me about this. What is the group Attorneys United for a Secure America, AUSA? It's part of the Immigration Reform Law Institute where you are. What are they doing in support of a lawsuit brought by the city or about regarding, in this case, the city of Cottage Grove, Oregon, and its police department? What's going on there with regard to the Sanctuary Promise Act?
Yes, the Sanctuary Promise Act blocks local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration law enforcement. And the way they cooperate is when they have an alien, an illegal alien in their custody, who's, because he's a criminal, he committed a crime, and they're going to release him at a certain point, ICE would like to know when that point is so they can come and pick him up and deport him.
Right.
And then So this law bans that kind of cooperation. It's all just to protect criminal aliens, or in many cases, criminal illegal aliens from deportation. And that is something that, in fact, people, in local law enforcement have a federal right to do. Congress has passed several laws allowing cooperation by local law enforcement in immigration law enforcement. And so when the state passes a law saying they can't cooperate, it's preempted. And that law is just in conflict with higher federal law.
And what it means in practice, Chris, doesn't it mean that if you're a local law enforcement person, you catch a drug dealer, you catch somebody who committed or is accused of committing an assault or a rape, or even, not other crimes, murder, they would typically be held in custody anyway. But you catch somebody, they're a problem, they're perhaps even a danger in your community, and you should be able to pick up the phone, call ICE, say, by the way, we picked up this guy after a bar fight or after an assault of some kind, or even a drunk driving. He's an illegal alien, or we believe he is. Could you come check him out? And if he's illegally in the country, take him away and remove him altogether.
Actually work like that. You might think it should, but Congress made the policy judgment that they're supposed to be punished first for their state crimes before they're deported.
Fair enough.
And so it's always people who've already been proven, but in court to have committed a crime and they've already been punished for it. And the local authorities want ICE to come pick up that person. And the state law says they can't do that. I guess they can't even go out in the parking lot and use their cell phone to call ICE. But clearly Congress gave them a right to do that, and also passed laws trying to encourage cooperation. And that purpose of encouraging cooperation is what's blocked by this kind of law. And that means it's preempted. It's called obstacle preemption.
So what is the city of Cottage Grove and its police department trying to do? What would they like the courts to say?
That they have a right to cooperate with ICE. They can make those phone calls. They can detain a person for 48 hours until ICE can come and pick them up.
But they're being sued, aren't they?
Yes, they're being sued to enforce this law. Some activist groups who support sanctuary laws are suing to enforce it, claiming that it makes their members feel unsafe, you know, to go to the police because, the justification for these sanctuary policies is, you know, they say that they're doing it not to protect criminal aliens, but to make the local communities trust the police. I don't know why the local communities would trust the police if they won't even help get rid of dangerous people in their communities.
Well, and in this case, if the community is supposed to trust you and the police arrest somebody who's accused of a crime, and as you said, they've now been adjudicated, they've been found to be guilty of assault or rape or other crimes that put the rest of the community in danger, wouldn't the community trust the police more? They said, by the way, we're not just going to punish him or her for the crime they've committed, person's committed, but we're going to see that they're removed because they're not here legally, and that somehow this is going to make the community distrust if they don't let the person go and ignore the immigration law?
Most crime is committed by repeat offenders, by career criminals. So you get rid of one, you stop many crimes, not just one crime, and that person will commit later. And usually we don't get the chance to remove, after people have served their time, we don't get the chance to remove criminals from our society. But when they're from foreign countries, they've violated the terms of their presence here.
Yeah, they're illegally in the country. They should be removed, not just from the community. In many cases, I know courts have said you have to go back to the community where you were convicted of this crime. In some cases, ironically enough, they do that. In this case, if the community knew, no, this person's going to leave not just the community, not just the state, but leave the country and be pushed out of the country and presumably kept out of the country, I would think the community would applaud that. Chris, good luck with the lawsuit. That's Chris Hayek, Director of Litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute. They're supporting one community that's saying, we want to cooperate with ICE. That's Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. We want to remove criminal, illegal aliens who have not just been criminal because they came into the country illegally, but committed crimes within the country. And they're supporting these police departments and cities that want to make this happen. Chris, thanks very much. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And I'll tell you about the public schools that I think are representing a clear and present danger to your kids. But at least some teachers are fighting back. And I'll tell you about that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Do you trust the public schools when you send your kids off? Now, I know a lot of parents have made, I think, a very wise decision. It was probably spurred in large part recently by the pandemic. But a lot of parents have said, I'm getting my kids out of there. It is a snake pit. Well, I hate to disappoint you or perhaps confirm your choice, but there are some schools out there that are doing things that are not just illogical, they're not just immoral, but they're just dead wrong. And I want to give you a very specific example, and I'm going to suggest to you that even if it already hasn't been raised as an issue in your community, it is likely happening in your community. So let me get to that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And we don't mind naysayers. In fact, we honor naysayers by putting you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You should send your emails to talk at LarsLarsonShow.com. LarsLarson.com. We tried to make that one as easy as possible. And cast a vote in our Twitter poll if you have a moment. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. So, about the public schools, hundreds of billions of dollars are spent on public education. As I remind people frequently, America funds K through 12, government provided for the most part, public education better than every single industrialized country on earth. Germany comes in second, but we are way ahead of them as well, and we're ahead of every other modern country in the world. So, when you hand your kids off to the public schools, there's an idea, a Latin phrase for it, it's kind of cool, in loco parentis, in place of the parents. It basically means that when you hand your kids off to the schools, they're in charge of your kids, but only temporarily. Then they go back to parents. Well, there are California schools that are literally telling the teachers, you must lie to the parents and we will train you how to lie. Now, if I make a bold charge like that, I would expect that you would say, well, Lars, you better back that one up, because that one sounds kind of crazy, that a school would tell the teachers working for that school, you must lie to the parents about something significant that is happening to their kids. So let me back it up. There are teachers at one California middle school, and as I said, fair warning, this is not just happening in one place in America, and not just because it's crazy California. The teachers at this middle school have now brought a lawsuit against their school district and the State Board of Education. It was actually filed today, because what they've said in this district, school, in this lawsuit, is that two teachers, Elizabeth Mirabelli and Lorianne West, one is Catholic, one is Christian, Protestant Christian. So they say that the school district is not only telling them you have to lie to the parents, but you have to compound that lie. Because if a child comes to you and says, I am going through gender transition. So we're talking about K through 12 schools, all kids under the age of 18. That if the child says, I'm transitioning boy to girl or girl to boy, you have to call them by whatever name they have chosen and whatever pronoun they have chosen. But, and this is where it gets really serious, if you have this information in your head and you talk to the parents of those children, you must deliberately hide from the parents any information about this very significant change that appears to be happening in this child. In other words, the child says, I'm going from being a boy to a girl, and you're required to call that student she in class and by whatever name they choose. But when you talk to the parents, you have to refer to the child by the original birth name of the child and the gender of the child. And here's what the lawsuit says. Under the policy, teachers must refer to students by their preferred pronouns or gender-specific names during school hours, but then revert to biological pronouns and legal names when speaking to the parents. The lawsuit says at Escondido, which is where the school is, Escondido Union School District, once a teacher learns of a child's social transitioning, he or she, according to the district, has an obligation to ensure the parents never find out. The policy states, quote, revealing a student's transgender status to individuals, and here's the favorite phrase for me, who do not have a legitimate need for the information without the student's consent is prohibited. This is a school district, a government agency, and that's important because governments are constrained by the law. They're constrained by the Constitution. They're telling the teacher, the parent of this child, who says he or she is going through this really significant transition that might actually include surgery, might actually include chemicals or, you know, pharmaceutical products to halt their puberty, that the parents have no legitimate need to know that information. It goes on, regardless of the student's age or circumstances, the policy says parents or caretakers are individuals who, quote, do not have a legitimate need for the information. Now, this is what's crazy. The district's own professional standards, which are published in the board policy manual, say, quote, being dishonest with students, parents, guardians, staff, or members of the public, that's a quote from the board policy manual, constitutes inappropriate conduct. That's in the lawsuit. Now, I'd agree with that. If you tell your teachers, if you're dishonest with the students, the parents, even members of the public who don't have kids in public school. That is inappropriate conduct for a professional. But under this policy, the district, and again, I'd remind you, this is not the only district that's doing it. There are many others in America, and I'll bet they're doing as much as they can to hide this from the voters, from the taxpayers, and from the citizens and parents out there. Under the policy, teachers will be trained to lie to what the district refers to as a suspicious parent. So in other words, a parent thinks something's up with my son or daughter. I don't know what it is. The only people, adults, primarily that they interact with are teachers and counselors and school administrators. Maybe I'll go to the school and I'll ask some questions and find out what's going on with my son or daughter. The teachers are then told, according to the lawsuit, to tell concerned parents, quote, the inquiry is outside the scope of the intent of their interaction. Sounds like a lawyer wrote it. And that they can only discuss, quote, information regarding the student's behavior as it relates to school, class rules, assignments, etc. On one hand, the district is telling the teachers, calling the kid by a different name and a different gender is part of your job as a teacher. So it is very much something that is involving the in-class learning of the student and the job of the teacher. And yet when the parent comes to ask about it, you're told, I'm sorry, that's outside of the scope of school, class rules, assignments, etc. They're telling the teachers to lie. And these two teachers, Elizabeth Mirabelli and Lorianne West, are saying, this is wrong. We're going to sue the school district. We're going to demand. Now, it sounds like if the district ever made an attempt to try to keep this secret from the people in that school district's population, whether it's parents, whether it's students, whether it is the taxpayers, whether it is the voters, no matter what class they fell into, this district is trying to hide all of this from the parents. And these teachers are saying, you are violating our First Amendment rights as a government agency to tell us to accommodate the gender change in class and lie to the parents outside of class. That's wrong, and I agree. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I suppose I should, as I often do, start with a confession and naming my dog in the fight. Have I had bad credit during my life? Yeah, I have. There was a time where I was kind of slack about paying my bills on time. I didn't have great credit. Do I have good credit now? Yeah, I do. I've become more diligent at that. Plus, putting some things on automatic payment makes a lot of sense. Am I proud of the fact that I've maintained good credit? Yeah, I am. And I know that a lot of you are, too, because when we heard about this news roughly a week ago, that the Biden administration was going to punish people with good credit and reward people with bad credit out of some misguided sense of justice. I said, we've got to talk about this. We got to get an expert on. So Roger Valdez joins me now, who is director of the Center for Housing Economics. He's also a research fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Roger, good to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Lars.
Have I misstated it when I say that the Biden administration is going to work through the federal agencies that grant a lot of the underlying loans or the, you know, the basis for most of the home loans in America by saying we're going to punish the people with good credit with a higher interest rate, in particular for buying a house, and we're going to reward people who have bad credit? Have I overstated that?
Well, it appears what's happening is they're trying to correct for some problems that are real, which is that the fact that Black households or African American households do not own homes at the same rate as white households. That is actually true. About 72% of white household, white families own a home, while only 44%. Black families own a home. And so this started a while back, and the effort, I think, was to try to correct for that. But this is a sort of a redistributive thing that ends up penalizing you if you have good credit instead of helping people improve their credit scores. And I think that's the real problem here.
I mean, because one of the things you can do, and it's a choice to do it, you can work hard, you can spend within your means, you can pay your bills on time, And usually in about 2, maybe 3 years of the outside, you're going to end up with good credit, aren't you?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that I think those of us that have, I have the same experience you did. I had terrible credit in my 20s, and then it took me a while to dig out of it, and now I've got really good credit. And it would make me really angry to show up with my good credit scores and then someone tell me, oh, it doesn't matter anymore, we're not using those, or we're using something else. I think that that the credit score is a motivator for good financial behavior. People, you know, as they get older and they get big, their incomes increase, they really do want to improve their credit score because it's a measure of their financial responsibility and success. And so that is something that I think we want to encourage. On the other hand, you know, there's nothing wrong with including other things in the credit score, like paying your rent. There's a company called Pinata that has set up a for-profit business around the idea of creating a reward system for people who pay their rent on time, for example. And rent is typically not reflected in the FICO score in the three main credit bureau reports. So there are things that this administration and that state and local government can do to help people who have, you know, bad credit or credit that doesn't exist, and to encourage them and support them as they do what everybody that's got credit has done, which is pay your bills on time and increase your earning potential and that sort of thing. And I think that that's where they should be going with this, rather than trying to put their finger on the scale and charge more for people that have good credit, which is essentially what this plan does.
It also seems like a way, and before we get to some other issues, it seems like a way to discourage people from being diligent about paying their bills. I mean, because if somebody says, look, I'm going to pay my bills on time, I've got bad credit, I want to get good credit, I want to buy a car, I want to buy a house, I want to do all those things, the barriers are staying in my way, I'm going to fix it. If all of a sudden the government comes in and effectively says, it doesn't matter anymore, you go, okay, I can go back to slacking on paying my bills on time. There's no penalty for it. In fact, there's a reward for it. Right.
Well, and it's even worse than that, because as I said in the post that I wrote at the Washington Times, there's a reason for recessing risk in an economy. You know, if you're going to be a lender and a borrower, the lender has to understand what is the risk I'm coming up against here when I loan money to Lars or Roger or whoever. And the credit score is a way of assessing that. If you get rid of it or you change it in a way where it changes those reflections of the measure of risk, it's going to affect the underwriting of the loans. And so the idea of changing that could lead to problems where people are getting mortgages that can't make those payments. And so that's another part of the problem, is that there's a reason to have assessment of credit and risk to assure that people can actually follow through and succeed at the mortgage that they're going to get.
Well, and what I think about, Roger, is my wife and I we saw a reduction in income in the 08 financial downturn. We saw a big drop in income. And you say, well, we're still going to pay our bills. There were a lot of people, even average income people, who said, I committed to this mortgage, I'm going to pay it, you know, and they weathered the storm and came out the other side. There were other people who just said, I'm just going to walk away from my mortgage. I got in for almost nothing. It may have been a ninja loan, so I'm just going to walk away from it. And you say, well, I don't want to loan money to people like that, or if I do, I'm going to charge them more. I think that's perfectly reasonable. Whereas the person who said, you know what, even during the downturn, we made sure that we put are paying our bills as a top priority, even when times were tough and we weathered it through, that ought to be rewarded, shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's not even you don't even look at the moral side of it, you just look at practically, you know, you're trying to make a decision about who to loan money to. The people that were diligent about paying their bills through a tough period of time are the people you know are going to pay you back, right?
Yep.
And so that's something that should be rewarded, and really just is, because of the way the market works. But if you start messing with that, it starts to distort that economy and creates some perverse incentives. And I think that you know, the idea is there's things like, for example, people that carry a bigger balance. You know, you're talking about the tough times. You know, there might be people out there who encounter a loss of income, and they have a big balance on a credit card, but they pay the minimum payment on time every single month.
Yep.
Well, the FICO score shows that that actually hurts your FICO score. So what I think, there's ideas out there that are like, well, maybe what we should do is give a little bit more weight to the people that, even though they have a bigger balance on that card, and you know, they hammered away at it, they make the minimum payments on time, consistently for a period of time, they should get some, you know, better. Their score should reflect that.
I'd go for that in a heartbeat.
Right, and that's the way you should do these things. But unfortunately, the way a lot of the resentment and the way that the bill was written that originally supports this or started in 2018, the study of all these scores, I think this, the result of trying to increase the cost for people with good credit and switch that around with people with bad credit sends the wrong signal to people. And it doesn't really help people, because if you can't make the payments every month, you're going to be in trouble. So what you want to do is build up people's financial capacity so they can succeed at that mortgage, become a homeowner, create that generational wealth, and solve the poverty problem that some families are in or have been in. But you can't do that if you just hand people a mortgage. If you start to obscure the risk patterns, that's not going to help anyone.
No, especially when you're saying if you've got bad credit, you may get as much as a 1.75% lower interest rate for having bad credit. That's Roger Valdez, who's director of the Center for Economic for Housing Economics and a research fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to get your calls. And this hour of the show, or this segment of the show, is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles if you choose, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today: should schools require teachers to lie to parents about a student's gender transition? I'd say no to that, of course. Apparently, a lot of schools are saying we're going to require teachers to lie to the parents and keep you in the dark. I think that's just dead wrong. Ought to be illegal. In any case, you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Speaking of that, should Northwest cities ban gasoline and diesel trucks from their downtown areas, as Portland is going to do with a 16-square-block area? They're going to ban all deliveries by trucks that are not, as they call it, zero emission. Although what's really happening is the emissions, if they're electric, the emissions are happening in China. So I guess that makes them zero emissions. Just make sure the pollution is in China. As we know, pollution from China doesn't drift anywhere else. 97% of you join me in saying no to that vote, that idea. Only 3% of you said yes. Love to talk to those naysayers. In any case, if you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS or 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Chris. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I 100% agree with you. It's driving me nuts, this May 1st Biden administration just passing that they can do whatever they want, it seems like. It's crazy to me.
You're talking about the home mortgage interest rates?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. You work your entire life to pay your bills and do what you my parents taught me that. Pay your bills on time, be a good citizen, do what you should do. And now it's just the ones that just say screw it and do whatever they want to do. It's insane to me.
It is. It's almost like a negative enforcement. In other words, most parents, if you give your kid an allowance every week or every month, you'd say to them, do your chores, you get your allowance. Don't do your chores, you don't get the allowance. What kind of kids would you raise if you said, by the way, you know, you're giving your daughter her allowance because she did everything, and her brother, Johnny, didn't do any of his chores at all. He sneered at the idea of taking the garbage out or mowing the lawn or whatever. And her daughter sees you giving Johnny his allowance, and she says, hey, I did all my chores. I got my allowance. He did nothing. he's still getting his allowance, and you say, yep, that's the way it works. That's the way government's going to treat you. Yep. You'd raise lousy kids, I think.
I agree with you, and unfortunately, that's it seems like, and I'm 46 years old, it seems like the generation, my generation split, half of us were okay, half of us are not so good. And
unbelievable.
This negative reinforcement is just crazy that, hey, we're going to punish you for doing what you should do to make up for those who didn't care and didn't do what they should have done.
Yeah, and Chris,
it's ridiculous.
Just so people understand how big a deal this is, if you're out shopping for a house, you probably go online, get one of those mortgage calculators. You say, okay, how much can we afford to spend? You kind of decide that. Then you plug that in and you say, how much house can I afford? And it tells you, it says, if you get this kind of house at this price, at this interest rate, you're going to, the payment is going to be this much. And you compare that to what you're paying now for rent or for your current house payment. You say, okay, we can afford that house. And then along comes Joe. Says, by the way, you've got good credit. You're going to get nicked for more. They haven't decided how much more yet. But the person with bad credit will get a 1.75% drop. If you ever take a given house, $400,000 in the Northwest, $500,000, $600,000, and put an interest rate in there, and then take 1.75 off and put it in again and see what the difference in payment is, it's gigantic.
It is, and I had to pay down those points. I had to get my interest rate where it is today, I had to pay down to get that extra 1% advantage.
It's crazy.
Even though I had credit, and people are getting rewarded for not paying anything.
For being deadbeats. And I'm sorry, if you don't pay your bills on time, you know, I understand you can have medical circumstances and other things outside of your control, but the point is, if you don't pay your bills on time, you got a problem. Let's go to Camden, who's calling in from the very liberal environment of Bellingham. Camden, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how you doing today?
Very, very well today. It's beautiful outside. We finally got some sun.
Absolutely, yeah. So I just wanted to give a little info regarding the that pronoun form. Those
yep.
teachers that are doing in California. Well, I don't know if you're aware, but we have those same forms here in Washington. I know for a fact in Bellingham School District.
Well, let me ask you something. It's not just the pronoun form, but is the Bellingham District telling its teachers, as the Escondido District is in California, are they saying to the teachers, you must lie to the parents, even if they're suspicious that something's going on? You're supposed to tell the parents a lie. You're supposed to lead them astray. Is that also the case in Bellingham? Do you know?
Well, so I don't know how much what I can say as far as regarding the superintendent of Bellingham Schools.
Name him.
But I know Greg Baker. My brother actually emailed him regarding that form, and because he was going through the DEI website on the Bellingham School page, and he came across this link to the GLSEN. It's a pronoun form for educators.
Yep.
And so he questioned. He emailed Dr. Greg Baker about it, and his response was, "This is a helpful form." And yes, I can certainly see a situation where a student could be asked to be referred to as a certain pronoun at school and that a different one in front of their parents.
Unbelievable. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you and always glad to serve the interests of the Pacific Northwest, the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, served by our Radio Northwest Network that's been in existence now for more than 23 years. Our Twitter poll today, should schools require teachers to lie to parents about a student's gender transition? Now, of course, my answer to that is no. The liberals and a lot of the school districts are requiring teachers to lie to parents, to even deceive and mislead parents about their student's gender transition, which is if they're deciding to do that kind of thing. If they're taking puberty blockers, chemical castration, double mastectomy for girls, I'd say that's a fairly significant thing in a young person's life. And if leading the parents astray is now the job that schools are assigning to teachers, to lie to the parents, then I think you should pull your kids out of public schools right now. Put them in private school, homeschool, tutoring, online, charter, whatever works. Those places are dangerous to your kids. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. And since I've tried as much as I can, whenever there is an opportunity to say, this is wrong, the schools are doing it wrong, and if you say to yourself, well, Lars, what do you suggest we do about it? Number one, get your kids out as fast as possible. And as an alternative, if you cannot do that, go to the next school board meeting and say, I demand to know, are teachers being told to lie to parents about something as significant as a child who is confused about gender and plans to transition? Maybe even seek state paid for and state assisted gender transition, meaning mutilation of that child. Demand to know, are you telling teachers to lie to the parents? And if the answer is not either no, it can't be I don't know, it can't be yes, you've got to demand that of school boards and make sure you record what they say and what you ask on video, too. Now, I want to have Pam Lewison join us, who's director of the Washington Policy Center's Initiative on Agriculture, for an entirely different subject. Pam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me today.
I have to tell you, I'm not a big fan of wolves. I'm not a big fan of the government bringing them back to the Pacific Northwest, especially since the wolves they've now reintroduced in both Oregon and Washington are not genetically the same wolves. They're bigger. They're perhaps more dangerous. We predicted years ago when they began to do this, they would become a problem, not so much for human beings, although there is a threat there, but for ranchers and farmers, they'd be a giant problem. So there's a possibility of getting the gray wolves delisted, isn't there?
I hope so. So my coworker, Todd Myers, and I wrote a little piece about trying to get wolves delisted in the easternmost third of Washington state. They are already federally delisted in that area, but the state maintains an ESA listing for them. If you look at just base numbers, they have reached a population where we consider them recovered based on numbers alone. And interestingly, so do the Confederated Colville tribes, as well as the other tribal communities that are in that sort of eastern third region of the state.
Yep.
So what we're asking for really is just parity with what the federal government is already saying, specifically so that it can provide some relief and potentially some protection measures for ranchers in that area.
Pam, let me ask you this. Not all the audience, I know, but not all the audience knows what the significance is of an animal being listed under the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, and what delisting would make possible. So please bring them up to date.
Sure. Any protected animal under the ESA, whether it's state or federal, killing that animal is a crime, and it comes with a pretty hefty fine and the potential for jail time as well. So delisting gives ranchers who in particular have livestock under attack from what are apex predators, the ability to protect their animals by shooting those wolves without fear of any kind of recrimination or potential punishment. Currently, if a wolf is, quote, caught in the act, meaning a rancher or their range rider sees a wolf actively eating a cow or a sheep, they have the ability to kill them now. However, caught in the act is really hard to do because wolves are naturally skittish. So what we have instead are a lot of dead sheep and dead cows, and wolves that are going to continue to habituate to do that without having some sort of deterrent beyond what's already existent. So,
and by the way, in the piece you and Todd wrote, you point out there are now 216 wolves and 19 breeding pairs, but if I remember Idaho's history correctly, they didn't put out tags and start to take down these animals till there were well over 1,000 in a state the size of Idaho. Washington could be in the same boat, couldn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we say that 216 wolves and 19 breeding pairs, what we really mean is that's the bare minimum. That's what the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife has been able to count. Certainly, you could argue, and I think everyone should, that there are significantly more wolves that have not been counted or tagged.
And I think that's, I've been in the outdoors a lot over the last 20 years. I've seen one cougar in the wild. I've seen no wolves with my own eyes. I've seen videos, but you know, my argument would be this kind of apex predator threat to livestock as well as potentially to humans. And you say, well, what's the benefit of them being there? They've been gone or were gone for about 70 years or more. And I've asked wildlife folks, so what's the benefit of having them there? They say, well, you know, people want to see them. I said, how many people have you talked to who have actually laid eyes on a wolf? And they'll say, well, almost nobody. You say, so it's like having something in the woods that's there so people can see it, but nobody ever sees it, or people rarely see them. I don't see the benefit, frankly.
I think the argument that some wildlife folks will make is that they hope that they will cull out ailing ungulates, so elk and deer that maybe are malnourished. Those are the animals that they're hoping they will target in their eating behaviors. But we don't necessarily see that. What we see is that because they're an apex predator and one that is an advantageous hunter, if the meat that's available is a cow or a sheep, that's what they're going to have. They're not.
Absolutely right. Pam Lewison is director of the Washington Policy Center Initiative on Agriculture. Pam, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. In a moment, I'm going to tell you about 1 million warrantless backdoor searches by the FBI and they were the wrong house. We'll talk about it next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Are you worried that the FBI admits it conducted 3.4 million warrantless backdoor searches? And then when you find out that one-third of those searches were actually the wrong place. Not only did they not have a warrant, they went to the wrong place. Now, we're talking about a gigantic number of warrantless backdoor searches into Americans' communications. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to have you with me. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can find that two places, at Lars Larson Show, if you don't mind Twitter. Or if you want to go to my website, vote at LarsLarsen.com. The vote counts the same. Don't vote like Democrats. Only cast one vote in the Twitter poll, if you don't mind. But this warrantless search nonsense, the more I hear about the FBI, the less I trust that agency. And that's been true for about the last 10 years. I don't know that I'd necessarily go back before then, but it seems that the FBI has been engaged in a whole lot of dirty business for a long time. Most notably in 2015, 8 years ago, when the FBI put false information before a federal FISA judge, the so-called Steele dossier, in which they lied on behalf of Joe Biden. They basically lied to help out Joe Biden, and they lied to help out Hillary Clinton. And this is just unconscionable. So let me tell you the evidence I have of what's been going on lately. And then if you want to jump into the conversation, you can certainly do that. Department of Justice Inspector General Michael Horowitz. Now, let me tell you, if you're not familiar with the IGs, almost every federal agency in America has an inspector general. Most of them have a number of these people who hold that title. And what does that mean? It means that there are inspector generals for the Pentagon, for the Department of Justice, as I said, for virtually every federal agency. And their job, even though they work at the agency, is to root out waste and corruption and other things and then bring it to the Congress and say, here's what I found. So in some ways, they serve the same kind of function that, say, internal affairs serves within American police agencies, that the folks in internal affairs are there to find out, are the police following the law? Are they going by procedure? Have they broken the rules? And are people getting hurt? Well, the Inspector General Michael Horowitz from the Department of Justice has now testified before the House of Representatives, before the Committee on Appropriations Subcommittee on Crime Fighting and Federal Government Surveillance. So we actually have to have an agency of the U.S. House of Representatives that's looking at the government's surveillance activities on American citizens. Now, if your reaction to that is, well, if you're engaged in criminal activity, maybe we should have law enforcement keeping an eye on you. Horowitz admitted to Representative Matt Gaetz that the FBI has now done 3.4 million warrantless backdoor searches of the communications of American citizens. Now, that should be stunning all by itself. The idea that the FBI, now, I could imagine circumstances, and I would give you as an example. If the agency believed that there were American citizens who are engaged in planning a terrorist attack. Heck, I think they ought to be going after Jane's Revenge and groups like that, the ones that have been setting fire to torching pregnancy resource centers, for example. I think back in the day, even before 9/11, the FBI said one of the biggest threats to Americans was domestic terrorism, most of it in the name of the environment. Groups like the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, they were engaged in terrorist activities. Some members of those groups were engaged in terrorist activities. Fine, do all the surveillance you want, but you need to have a good reason. So here's what Gaetz asked of Horowitz. I want to get into the 3.4 million backdoor searches that a ranking member pointed out in his opening statement. So all these members of Congress get their opening statement to kind of set the table for what they're going to do when they interview somebody, when they hear testimony from somebody like Horowitz. How should the public think about these? And here's what Horowitz did. He said, well, I think what we've seen in various public reports, and I'm limited in what I can say about what's public, and most people who testify to Congress on things like this are limited in what they can say. You don't want to give away the store to the bad guys. But he says, which I think is one of the issues, by the way, that's worth talking about transparently here. It's obviously very concerning that there is a volume of searches, 3.4 million, and particularly concerning the error rate that was reported on in the last 2 years in public reporting. Now, I'm not going to guess that most of the public reports on this subject tell the full story, because we may only know the half of it. Horowitz revealed an error rate of 30%, or about 1 million erroneous searches. He says, I'm not a lawyer, this is what Gaetz said, Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida. I'm not a lawyer, not a mathematician, but 3.4 million, about 30%, you're talking about seven figures, more than a million figures in error in terms of the searches. So the fact that we've given the FBI, this agency, so very much authority to go out and do these searches, and then the fact that the FBI has used that authority to carry out millions of warrantless searches, which, as I said, in the right circumstances, for the right reasons, if you're going after a criminal enterprise, if you're going after domestic terrorism, then in some cases, I could see that kind of search being justified. Say, let's take a look at the communications of these people. Otherwise, how do you catch the bad guys in that case? But the fact that their error rate means a million warrantless searches done by the FBI, not on foreign terrorists on American soil, but based on innocent Americans who've done nothing wrong. So ordinarily, if you're driving down the street and a police officer wants to pull you over, he can only pull you over and even stop you on the road if he has some reason to believe that either you're in some peril, you know, something wrong with your car, he could pull you over if you have committed a traffic infraction. He can use that if he has probable cause or reasonable suspicion to believe that you've committed a crime. Otherwise, you can't. I mean, police agencies in general in America are constrained by the U.S. Constitution. that you can only get a warrant to do a search if you can show reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. The fact that the FBI is doing, without a warrant, 3.4 million searches of Americans' communication. So your email, your phone calls, your text messaging, all of those things that you expect to be private. And you expect, you have some reasonable expectation, as the lawyers might say, that what you communicate, no matter what it is going to be private unless they can show that there was reasonable suspicion that you're engaged in some criminal activity. But as I said, there could be, and probably are, cases where you have to say, well, if we're going to catch these bad guys, these terrorists, we can't go get a warrant because then they know that we're watching them. And in that case, then you may have to do it without a warrant. 3.4 million and a million of them done in error. That is absolutely outrageous. I think the FBI needs to be shut down and reformed or something else. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you listen to this show regularly, you know that there is certainly no regard and frankly, no respect for the American Federation of Teachers and its president, Randy Weingarten, who has played, I think, an absolutely evil role in the lives of parents, children, school children in particular, and America's schools, using her position for political purposes to benefit one party in particular, and that would be the Democrat Party. And nobody knows that better than Aaron Wythe, who is the CEO of the Freedom Foundation. Aaron, it's good to have you back.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me back on.
Randy Weingarten really has a lot of a mess to clean up, and it doesn't seem as though she's doing a fantastic job in her testimony before the Congress or her public statements either. Would you agree with that assessment?
That's putting it lightly. Randy Weingarten is trying to she thinks that we have no memories here. She tries to claim that she was the one trying to reopen schools, yet you and I spoke several times last during COVID about how her and her union was shutting down schools. That was her whole goal. Her goal was to keep schools shut so that she could advocate for her largely political agenda, and she used our kids and their education as leverage to go out and do that. It was completely sick, and I'm happy that Congress called her out, made her go and testify yesterday, and have some accountability for her actions.
I guess I have a problem with the whole idea of public employees being represented by unions anyway. And I know some of the people listening to the show are public employees and they're represented by unions and they like it. But I guess the trouble I have as a citizen is that, say, take almost any state in America, figure out how many teachers are in the state. You know, typically it might be in an average size state, 50, 70,000 teachers. Multiply by 1,000, which gets you the number of dollars that the union typically gets from its members. So you say, okay, you know, the union in a state that represents the teachers has $70 million. And you say, how much does it really cost for them to represent groups of teachers and renegotiate their contracts? A fraction of the $70 million. And if you wonder, well, where's the extra money go? It goes to politics, pure partisan politics. And I think the numbers are right north of 95% of it goes to the Democrats, who then go into the legislature or the Congress and say, we got to give the teachers more. That's a really troubling, not just troubling. I think it's a fraudulent arrangement to say we're going to allow them to be represented, gather up that kind of money, and then use it both to benefit politicians who then benefit the teachers, this incestuous relationship they've got.
Yeah, you articulated it perfectly, Lars. The Freedom Foundation did an expose a few months ago around the National Education Association, not Randy's union, but the largest union in the country. And we found out that they spent 7.5% of their budget on representational services. This is a $300 million plus budget, by the way. $7.5% went on representational services. Over 50% of their budget was spent on political gifts, lobbying, and gifts to political nonprofits. So when you think about the agenda of the teachers' unions, they are not some trade association type group that exists to provide benefits to members. Their sole purpose is political gain. And that's what we saw during COVID. That's why the Freedom Foundation fights these unions so hard.
Well, and it almost sounds as though average citizens, parents, and the students or the children of those parents have almost no chance of beating that. You walk into the Congress, you walk into the state legislature, and the union's there with tens of millions of dollars it can hand out to the politicians, and the parents are there saying, don't put this disgusting pornography in front of my kids at school. Don't do these things to our kids, or keep the schools open, for goodness sake. And the union says, no, we don't want to. And the politicians know where the checks are biggest, and they're going to say, oh, I mean, at least certain of the politicians, some will resist that. The Republicans certainly will, because the Republicans get, did you have a percentage of what amount of the teachers union? I almost have to laugh when I ask, the amount of the teachers union political contributions that go to Republicans?
Yeah, over 98% of their contributions go to Democrats, and those that do go to Republicans are Republicans that they know they can control. It's a total disaster what they've been able to do by extracting this money from your everyday teachers. The example that she was testifying on yesterday was that she gave government unions in total gave Joe Biden $76 million to run for president. And then when it comes to writing the guidance from the CDC to, quote, reopen schools, which really meant keep schools shut, Randy was able to actually write the language that was then used by liberal governors across America as coverage to keep schools closed. While at the same time, we had conservative governors that did not listen to Randy Weingarten, they did not listen to the CDC, and we had kids that were far better off than they were in Democrat states.
No, and when you think about that, that works against the interests of parents, against the interests of children, but totally in favor. I mean, most unions would say we want our people on the job with a great paycheck and great benefits. Okay, I understand that's what unions are there to advocate for. But to say we'd like our teachers to get the paychecks and the benefits and they don't have to show up and work. She's actually achieved something that I don't think has ever happened. Not that it's a good thing from my point of view, but she achieved something that no other union, you never saw the United Auto Workers Union say, by the way, would it be okay if our guys and gals show up on the assembly line and didn't make cars, but you still sent the paychecks to them? I don't think any other union in human history has achieved that, have they?
No, not to my knowledge. It was right. You're right. It was incredible what she was able to do and the damage that was done as a result of it. But I think what we've seen in response, Lars, is encouraging. We've seen that parents have been voting for non-teachers union candidates, particularly at the school board level. We've seen parents also take their kids out of public schools where that's a possibility and put them into charter schools or, if they can afford it, private schools. And then we've also seen teachers leave unions at a rate that has never happened before. Over the last couple of years, hundreds of thousands of teachers have opted out of putting money into Randy Weingarten's union and the National Education Association and their union. They're putting $1,100 a year back in their pockets and out of these unions' radical political agenda.
And that takes away
their best days are over. Go ahead.
Sorry about that, Aaron. But that takes away a lot of the union's political power, and that's good. Because I'd remind people of something else as well. Not only did they leave the kids far behind, but many of those teachers' unions went to their respective districts and said, we have fewer kids to teach, and that means we need more money to do the job. And I never expected any citizen, no average citizen, would say, you mean you did a lousy job of teaching our kids. You now have a lot of kids who've been pulled out. You have fewer kids to teach, and you want more money to do a smaller job? I mean, I don't know that that makes sense to anybody except Randy Weingarten.
No, it doesn't. And one of the examples that we can see of that is the unions came begging for money from Congress to reopen schools, hundreds of millions of dollars that they were asking for. And then when they got the money in the form of the CARES Act or the HEROES Act, I forget which one, when they got that money, they actually only spent 15% of the dollars that Congress allocated for them to reopen schools. They wouldn't even know what to do with this money if they had it, but they're always crying for it because they always want to hire more bureaucrats, more teachers that they can take money from and extort union dues from.
Well, Aaron, sometimes I'm accused of never offering solutions. Here's the solution. You got 85% of the money left? Run a summer school for every kid who's fallen behind. Give some extra counseling, you know, some extra tutoring. Mississippi has done that with a tiny amount of money, and they've seen gigantic results. I think Tate Reeves was absolutely right to do that. That's Aaron Wythe, who's the CEO of the Freedom Foundation. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And next on the Radio Northwest Network, tax dollars to promote private booze? I don't think so. And it's the Radio Northwest Network that serves the Pacific Northwest. If we're doing our job right, we serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And if you want to jump into the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS, and naysayers always go first. And this segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. Let's go to Jerry first. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. Yeah, earlier today, you were on the show, you were talking about the sanctuary policy in Oregon and how there's a... to me, it seems like I'm torn between two different ways to feel. It's like, on the one hand, I don't think that the state has a right to, you know, overrule the federal government when it comes to, you know, deporting illegal aliens. But on the other hand, in Texas, you know, Governor Abbott has the state of Texas, like National Guard, actually apprehending and deporting aliens. And
so, Jerry, let me correct one thing. And if I'm wrong, I'll be glad to be told I'm wrong. What Abbott did was he said, we have this illegal alien problem. We can't enforce immigration law. But what we can do is if they go out to the area where the illegals come in and they find somebody trespassing, those people can be arrested for trespass. So he's using the law in a way that's legal. Arizona during Obama said, we're going to enforce immigration law. This was under the sheriff of Maricopa County, who I had great admiration for, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. They actually said, we're going to enforce immigration law. And the federal court said, you can't enforce federal immigration law. You cannot. It's the sole province of the federal government. That is true. But if what you say is, if we have an illegal alien problem, and let me compare it to something. Did Al Capone ever go to prison for murder?
No, it was tax evasion.
Tax evasion. So, in other words, you say we got a bad guy. We can't get him on murder, but he is guilty of tax evasion. So we'll just put him in prison on tax evasion. Problem solved. Now, was there any problem with doing him for tax evasion when you couldn't get him for murder and all the other mayhem that Al Capone brought about? Did you disagree with that?
Not at all.
Then if Governor Abbott says we can't go out and arrest somebody for being an illegal alien, but we can arrest them for trespass, we can arrest them for any of the other things that they are guilty of, because once they're in the country, we'll ignore their illegal status, we'll arrest them for the other crimes they're committing, even if they're relatively minor crimes like trespass, we'll arrest them for that. So I think that's actually a very good workaround. In the case of the thing we were talking about earlier, which is City of Cottage Grove and his police department have said, look, there's a state law that says we are not to even pick up the phone and call ICE and say we've arrested somebody for whatever it is, DUI, assault, whatever, and we're going to notify ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, this person appears to be in the country illegally. All they're doing is notifying a sister law enforcement agency of a different kind of crime. In the same way that if a person, and you know this happens all the time, Jerry, somebody gets stopped in Oregon, mm-hmm. Washington, or Idaho for driving too fast. And when the police officer pulls him over, says, hey, this guy is also accused of murder in Arkansas, for example. There is actually a case involving a guy like that.
He's a criminal alien, as opposed to
he's a criminal alien, but you're arresting him for a state crime. The state crime is trespass. They're not arresting him for breaking the immigration laws. Now, should Cottage Grove be able to call ICE and say, we got this guy for this, you want him for that, come get him?
Yeah, I think they should.
And that's all they're saying. They brought a lawsuit saying this city and its police department have the right to violate a state law that runs counter to you know, to enforcing federal immigration law. They're not actually enforcing federal immigration law. They're just saying, we're going to tell you about him. You want to pick him up? Come pick him up.
Yeah, the thing is, Lars, it's like a dichotomy between, okay, on the one hand, you have the state has the right to do they or do they not have the right to not go along with the federal government?
I don't think they do.
And then on the other hand, in Texas, you have, you know, the state does have the right to do what the federal government does not want them to do by stopping and deporting aliens.
Well, but they are not stopping, they are not deporting. They're saying, we've arrested this man for trespass. He appears to be in the country illegally. ICE, we're letting you know we've got this guy in custody. If you want to get him on immigration law, you can come and get him. In the same way that if a killer from, you know, Nevada comes to Washington State or Oregon and gets stopped for speeding or drunk driving, and the police officer says, hey, we're getting you for drunk driving, but we're going to notify Nevada that we appear to have caught one of Nevada's fugitives. They're not enforcing Nevada law. They're simply saying, we've got him in custody for one thing. You want him for something else. If you want him, come and get him. And in fact, Jerry, if a friend of yours, I know you don't have friends like this, but if a friend of yours showed up at the door and said, hey, the cops are looking for me, will you hide me from the cops? Would you do that?
No, I wouldn't.
No, because you would be guilty of what crime? Harboring a fugitive. Now, if your friend just says, hey, can I come hang at your house, and he doesn't tell you why he's there, he might get away with it by keeping you in the dark and you wouldn't be guilty of anything. But if he said, I'm hiding from the cops, will you hide me from the cops? You go along with that, you're probably going to jail as well. And I'm not a lawyer. Jerry, thank you for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.